welcome, everybody. Great to see a big turnout here. Got a lot to cover today, and I'm a facilitator. My main job is to make this a productive use of some very high-powered talent today, so I'm going to do my best on that. I want to my name's Paul Norman. I worked for Bonneville for a long time. Now I'm in retirement and just a facilitator for this group. Let's start with some going around the table introductions, and I'll go your way, Lisa.
Okay. Good morning. I'm Lisa Groh with Idaho Power Company.
Surrounded by mine.
Sure. Dick Storo with Avistacorp.
I'm Amy Holden with Snohomish PUD.
Jim Lobdell, Portland General Electric.
Rachel Shimshack, Renewable Northwest Project.
Jeff Goltz, Washington Utilities and Transportation Commission.
Scott Corwin, Public Power Council.
John Prescott, PNGC Power.
Bill Drummond, Western Montana G&T.
Brian Skank, Calis Public Utility District.
Travis Kavula, Montana Public Service Commission.
Mark Mayer, WECC.
Roby Roberts, Horizon Wind Energy.
John Savage, Oregon PUC.
Don Furman, Iberdrola.
Jorge Carrasco with Seattle City Light.
Teresa Conway, PowerX Corp.
John Savin, Northwest Requirements Utilities.
Jim Culbertson, Grant PUD.
David Mills, Puget Sound Energy.
Ken Dragoon, Northwest Power and Conservation Council.
Elliot Mainzer, BPA.
Steve Wright, Bonneville Power.
Tom Carrier, Northwest Power and Conservation Council.
Great, thanks. And Paul Schlander, are you out there on the phone? Sounds like maybe not. So he was. And any other steering committee member on the telephone? Okay, well, that's great. We have so many people here. I just want to note the fact that since this group last met 18 months ago, there's a number of new members. Jeff Goltz with the WTC, welcome. Travis Kavula. Greg Reamer, who at the last minute couldn't make it. He's from BC Hydro. Lisa Groh. Mike Cashel, who is, I think, going to be here. Mark Mayer and John Savin and Roby Roberts. So some good new additions. Just briefly, the agenda, really, our agenda has two parts. The first part is just to get us all on the same factual basis for about the wind industry, and Elliot's going to lead that off, and we're going to ask you to weigh in on initially not what are solutions, but rather what's actually happening out there and what's likely to happen in terms of wind development and its benefits and challenges. Then in the afternoon, we're going to turn to action planning, second part of the meeting where we're going to start with really taking a kind of a poll of the steering committee members about ideas for what we ought to be doing that we're not already doing, and hopefully narrow that down by the end of the day to a set of action items. We have a fairly large steering committee. It's been chosen to try to be fairly representative of the folks who are involved in, impacted by wind development in the region. For that reason, we've been, and the fact that it is a big group, a lot to do, we haven't provided for comments by other than steering committee members in this meeting. If you really absolutely feel like something hasn't been said by someone around the meeting, and it's really important, there's going to be a little bit of time at the end of the meeting for folks who aren't part of the steering committee to weigh in. But apart from that, we haven't made provision for comments from others. And the folks on the phone who are listening in, sorry, but you're on mute. You can't talk. So apologize for that. However, there's the council is, by the end of the week, they're going to put up a web-based forum for, you know, anyone who's got a perspective on this who wants to weigh in. There will be an electronic place, and we either steering committees will either see that or that input will get summarized for them to see. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Tom Furrier for some introductory remarks.
Okay. Thanks, Paul. It's great to see such a good turnout here today, and thank everyone for coming to work on this topic. An event like this doesn't happen without a lot of staff work, and I want to begin by thanking particular individuals who helped arrange some of the logistics. Jillian Charles from our staff and Joanne Black worked on setting this up with pretty short notice. Terry Moreland's been working on this from our division. I think this was the first kind of official time that Ken Dragoon is in front of the Wind Integration Forum, and he started with the council a little while ago, taking over for Jeff King, who's worked on this topic for several years, and joining together with Elliot Manger. So we still have a great collaborative going between Bonneville and the council staff to try to help organize this forum. It was Mark Twain who said that everybody complains about the weather, but no one does anything about it. And in the Northwest, we may not do anything about the weather, but we do a lot with the weather. We use it to create our energy through hydro, through wind, through eventually solar. And the context for this meeting, I think, is pretty obvious, that we've had a significant and rapid expansion of wind in the Northwest, driven by portfolio standards in Washington, Oregon, Montana, and California. When the council released its fifth power plan, which was before the sixth power plan, 5 years before, we expected, even back then, we expected 6,000 megawatts of wind, which seemed like a lot at the time, over a 20-year period. Well, we're rapidly approaching that 6,000 megawatts today, and our sixth plan has even more wind in it. We're all tracking this, and we'll hear more about the forecasts of additional wind today. But no matter what happens with what's in California, I think there's great uncertainty about what will happen to the development of wind based on the caps that now exist in California and the restrictions on imports. But we know that there are targets for Washington and Oregon that are kicking in the next 10 or 15 years that will result in a significant future development of wind coming up. As you know, we've made a lot of progress on the integration aspects of this in the region. We started with a plan 4 years ago, an action plan 3 or 4 years ago, and we accomplished much of that work. Some of it is in place now, and some of it has led to more advanced work that's still ongoing. I've thought of this more as a process of continuous improvement than one that will ever be a finished process. I'm not sure we'll ever be able to say in the Northwest, good, we finally integrated wind. It'll always be something we'll be trying to improve. In your reading assignment that Paul sent out, you can see that wind integration is becoming very complex. It's widely dispersed geographically and institutionally. The major strength of this forum, I think, is to involve the region in understanding and tracking all of these various efforts and to also identify overlooked opportunities. And that's one thing that we're always looking for here. From the start, we probably underestimated the region's ability to manage conditions of excess supply. The region is facing the consequences of that today. And I see this as another opportunity for the forum, which is to highlight and prioritize some of the long and short-term solutions to this issue and to address this systematically going forward. And before I pass this off to Steve, I want to emphasize that one thing we want to come out with at the end of this day is to consider the future role of the forum. Are we going to continue to be a coordinating platform for wind integration in the region? And are we going to continue to support regional processes, which means through your technical staff and others, to evaluate and prioritize solutions to oversupply? I think this steering committee, with the help of our technical staff, can make progress on oversupply solutions, just as we have on many of the other wind integration challenges. But it's most important what all of you think, which, if any of the ideas we discussed today, should be pursued and tracked through regional efforts, which ones should be pursued more individually on a case-by-case basis. So thanks, and I'll turn it over to Steve Wright.
Thank you, Tom and Paul. I want to start by recognizing that we have a new facilitator for this effort, and if everyone would just take a moment, I hope that if you see Walt Pollack around sometime in the course of the next 6 months or year, you'll thank him for his steadfast efforts. He has led us, and I think in an extraordinary fashion, and he's decided that it's time for him to do some other things, including retirement, but we are appreciative of the great work that he has done. And I'm grateful to Paul, who we went out and solicited and said, you've done a lot of work in this area for a long time, and we expect Paul will do a fantastic job in the role of facilitator as well. With respect to today's agenda, it is time, I think, to celebrate success on the issues this committee was charged with addressing when we first formed oh so many years ago. We are roughly a decade ahead of schedule for wind power development from the time when this task force was initiated with about 3,500 megawatts of wind now on the Bonneville system and close to 6,000 megawatts in the Northwest. I do recall our first meeting when Rachel Shimshak suggested that we should be thinking about maybe 6,000 to 10,000 megawatts, and I have to admit at that time when you said that, Rachel, I thought, well, that seems like something that's pretty far-fetched, and maybe we should focus on some more near-term objectives. So I have learned about your ability to forecast the future, and we'll certainly be paying attention as you speak today.
Don't be buying stock.
Many of the initiatives of this group have led to the explosion of wind power, including the support for building more regional transmission. As we speak, Bonneville is pursuing four major transmission projects in the Northwest that cumulatively will provide transmission access to approximately 7,000 megawatts of wind. These projects are in various stages, ranging from nearing completion to undergoing environmental review. But the success that we have seen does beget challenges. Today, we will be looking from a regional perspective at where the potential need is for new renewable resources. We will also be looking at some of the big challenges created by adding substantial amounts of variable energy resources to the electricity supply mix. From my perspective, there are three major challenges that have arisen for electric system operations as a result of adding wind to an already complex system. First, the issues associated with balancing. We know that variable energy resources tend to ramp up and down, not always consistent with schedule, and that creates challenges in terms of maintaining reliability. Second, the issues associated with the potential for periodic undersupply of energy. There are limited amounts of capacity that are provided by variable energy resources, which creates the potential, at least, for having an undersupply situation and a need for more flexible capacity. And finally, the issues associated with periodic oversupply of energy, once again, where we are not expecting certain amounts of energy to show up, and they do, and then we end up with more electricity than we need on the system. Looking back at the history of this group, we spent a substantial amount of time in this forum considering how to address the balancing issues. We also discussed the need to consider the potential for periodic undersupply of energy. We did not spend as much time on the periodic oversupply challenge that we are now confronted with. What I hope we will hear today is where we are and where we need to place emphasis going forward relative to these three fundamental challenges. My sense is that there is a lot of activity seeking to address the balancing issues, and that there also has been a fair amount of discussion in the region with respect to periodic undersupply. But there is a need for more activity in the arena of considering what options there are for addressing periodic oversupply issues. From a regional perspective, what does the supply curve look like for addressing periodic oversupply? What types of actions from interregional transmission to storage options to demand response are available? And what makes the most sense if we operated the system as one utility? It's important to understand that not all problems justify a capital investment, and we will have to see whether, in fact, the excess supply issues justify large expenditures to move or store energy. Once we understand that, we will almost certainly have a discussion about who pays for such measures. But for today, I hope we can put that aside and focus on what makes the most sense from a one-utility regional perspective. I do hope that today, as with our previous meetings, we can all learn something and identify some high-priority work that needs to move forward to support our regional and national clean energy agenda. And I want to emphasize Tom's final point. This is a completely volunteer activity. This group does not have a statutory charter. There's no legislation that says we have to exist. We exist only because we have come together because we have found it is an opportunity for us to talk as a region and to be able to find potential solutions to the issues that we are struggling with. Our success going forward will continue to depend on our willingness to be able to work together to find regional solutions. With that, Paul, I turn it back over to you.
I want to add a few people to the intro. So when I made calls before this meeting, a lot of folks said, boy, you know, what's happening in California? How's that going to drive the regional wind development. So Elliot lined up a few people from California to join us today. They're not on the agenda per se, but they're going to be here as resources to help answer some of those questions. So briefly, we have Dave Dockham from NCPA. We have Mark Ulrich. Are you on the phone?
They're on mute.
Nope, apparently not. Jerry's going to be on the phone. And then Neil Millar from the ISO is all here. So thanks for joining us today. Really appreciate you coming up. Elliot's going to kick off the first part of the agenda, which, again, we're on the factual part now. We're not on solutions yet. We're just trying to establish a basis of facts from which we can talk about solutions. So Elliot's going to go through a presentation on this. I'd like to ask you to, if you have clarifying questions you really need to ask Elliot, go ahead and interrupt him and do so. But for the most part, we want to get through this factual part. And after he's done with that, we have a panel that's going to briefly supplement what Elliot said. And then we're going to turn to the steering committee members. And we have about 45 minutes set aside for you to weigh in on your view of this. Again, not the solutions, but what's going on. So this is the learning from each other's experience part of the meeting, which is probably at least as important as the solutions. So, Elliot?
Okay. Thank you, Paul. Great to see everybody this morning. Appreciate the interest. Thank you, Steve and Tom, for the introductory comments. I think what we're going to do here, Ken and I, we're going to probably add a significant amount of additional detail and color to some of the themes that have already emerged here this morning. And as you see, our presentation is called Checking Facts and Connecting Dots. I think one of our principal objectives with this presentation this morning are to really try to get grounded in the fundamentals concerning our current wind fleet and the regulatory demand for renewables by 2020, and we'll talk a little bit beyond 2020 as well. Try to really explain and make sure everybody has a clean, intuitive understanding of these three interrelated challenges of balancing, oversupply, and flexibility adequacy in the context of the region's broader load resource balance, because all of these things are interrelated, and it's all part of the broader challenge of maintaining an adequate and efficient and economical power system. Third, we're going to try to review the multiple regional activities that address these challenges and for which additional solutions may be available over time. I'd really like everybody to walk away today. Hopefully, people have had a chance to do their homework and read the, I think it's 22-page primer on all of the activities that are underway in the region. I think there are a lot of people in this room, as I look around, who have worked very hard on those initiatives, and I want folks to really understand the very, very substantive body of work that's underway in this region, particularly with respect to the balancing and flexibility adequacy issues. And then also throughout the presentation, we'll talk a little bit about the role of additional transmission in the solution set, because that's clearly been very high on people's agenda for a long time. So here's a hopefully that's in reasonable focus. As Steve mentioned, I think those of us who were sitting back in August of 2006 when we first started looking at the kind of numbers thought, I think there probably would have been a significant number of people that would have taken the under on whether the Northwest would be at 6,000 megawatts of wind energy by 2011. But we are there. By the end of this year, if you look at what's actually in the ground and under construction as of June right now, this region will have 6,000 megawatts of wind energy by the end of this year. And I think it's useful for folks to try to stay grounded in what the actual renewable portfolio standards are. Of course, we're impacted very heavily by RPS from four states, obviously Montana, Washington, and Oregon, with Montana and Washington both aiming for 15% by 2020 and Oregon ratcheting to 20% by 2020 and then up to 25% by 2025. But obviously we've also been impacted and will continue to be impacted by California, which most recently passed a 33% by 2020 RPS. So we are part of a broad region and being providing solutions and being impacted by broad regional public policy objectives. Go to the next slide. I think it seems to be of interest to folks where the actual ownership and geographical distribution of the wind is actually located. Right now, the current wind, if you look at the 2011 bar, the 6,000 megawatts is distributed about 1,100 megawatts between Bonneville and Northwest Publics, about 2,200 megawatts under contract to Northwest IOUs, another 2,200 megawatts under medium to long-term contracts with California, and there appears to be about 500 megawatts of merchant wind generation right now that does not appear to have found a long-term buyer. Geographically, we have 471 megawatts in Idaho, 378 in Montana, and then you've got close to 2,600 megawatts in Oregon and close to 2,700 megawatts in Washington. And then Wyoming, certainly there's quite a bit more wind in Wyoming on the east side, but of the wind that's under contract to Northwest Utilities, it's about 135 megawatts. So pretty interesting geographical diversity of the wind. It's interesting, just if anybody's interested, of the big Oregon and Washington concentration there, you know, we're looking at about 5,300 megawatts Oregon, Washington, and about 10% of that is under contract to PAC and the PAC West Balancing Authority, 8% under contract to Puget, I'm sorry, within the Puget Balancing Authority. The Mid-Seas integrate about 1% of it, and Bonneville at the moment is hosting about 80% of that wind. So pretty interesting concentrations. I do note that PacifiCorp, of course, as a utility, has close to 2,000 megawatts of wind on their system. The majority of it, about 1,400 megawatts, concentrated in PAC East. So they've got a lot on their system and grappling with many of the same issues. But, of course, the RPS requirements are having us build quite quickly, almost by definition, in advance of load growth to sort of catch up and establish these concentrations in our resource portfolios. So I want to move on.
Got a question.
I was just going to make the point, which I know is obvious, but the renewable standards are renewable energy standards. They're not wind energy standards. They've certainly substantially been met by wind, but there are hydro and biomass and geothermal and solar and other resources meeting them as well.
Ken notes that there right now the non-wind is about 15% of the portfolio at this point. Yeah, thanks, Rachel. It's an important point. So we didn't have access to data from a lot of different systems. We wanted to give folks a little bit of a sense of how the actual wind, at least on the Bonneville system, is performing, has been performing between 2007 and 2010. As you can see, the average annual capacity factor of the fleet has been right around 30%, and that's varied from a pretty good wind year in 2008 at 33.1 down to 27.1% in 2010. And as you can see, the wind has been pretty heavily concentrated between March and August, peaking out in June, not surprisingly, and with definitely a slight bias towards light load off-peak generation rather than the heavy load generation, and then sort of tapering off and sort of tightening up between September and February. So there's sort of an initial look at how our fleet is actually performing in terms of its distribution of energy at the moment. And so we took a shot using some of the standard economic forecasting models that are available through NREL, EPA, USDOE, et cetera, to try to capture, at least start estimating ballpark what some of the economic benefits of this wind regime are, because I think that's an important part of the storyline. We're looking at about $30 to $60 million in annual tax revenues, $12 to $30 million in annual royalty payments, 350 to 650 new permanent jobs, and been averaging about 300 temporary construction jobs each year. This, of course, is off a pretty massive capital investment, about $12 billion estimated. So obviously, a substantial fraction of that $12 billion is probably going to turbine suppliers, not all of whom are located in the Pacific Northwest, but there's certainly a trickle down broader, you know, economic benefits, and some suppliers and capital trickle down into this region. But as we'll talk in the next slides, certainly a significant fraction of that is going to end up in rate base. And we also tried to take a shot at capturing some of the environmental benefits. This is something for me that I think is important. At the end of the day, I think one of the principal reasons that I think policymakers have been passing these types of regulations, the renewable portfolio standards, is to try to take on fossil fuel emissions and to reduce CO2 emissions. We've taken a quick estimate with some of the models that CO2 emissions have resulted in about 30 million tons reductions. The 2011 reduction would be equivalent to removing about a million cars off the road, and we've also had a substantial reduction in nitrogen oxide emissions. We'll be interested over the course of the day if folks have any alternative perspectives on that. But then, of course, there's the cost side of the ledger, And I think it's important to remember that in terms of the different categories of costs, we're certainly looking at utility procurement costs and their associated rate impacts. As this substantial capital investment works its way into rate base, we'll get to learn more about that. Obviously, we've got wind integration charges and balancing costs. I think Bonneville at the moment is collecting somewhere between about $60 million a year for wind integration. Part of that's revenue to the agency. That's expense to others. And, of course, the utilities who have substantial amounts of wind on their system are incurring costs associated with changes in their operation. So there's operational and integration costs. And then there's this big phenomenon that we've begun to grapple with of the fact that the increasing wind generation is lowering wholesale energy prices in the region. Now, whether that's a cost or a benefit depends, quite frankly, on your market position. The lower prices certainly benefit the short buyers and can harm the economics of the long sellers. And the council analysis, the oversupply paper, which you are all furnished with, suggests that RPS resources reduced annual average wholesale market prices by about 4 to 8% by 2020 and as much as 20% during the spring. So there is definitely a disproportionate impact on the economics of hydro just given its classic shape of generation. But certainly there are folks on the other side of that who all have a different perspective on those economics. One of the things that we are definitely beginning to grapple with a little bit, Bonneville, is possible increased wear and tear on balancing units, especially hydro. It's a lot more regulation, a lot more flexibility. We don't have a great handle on that yet, but we have initiated some studies to try to look at that. And I think that, in general, a better understanding of these impacts is going to require additional information analysis, and maybe across the course of the day we'll hear a little bit more on that, but certainly part of the equation. So this this is an important slide for us. We're going to spend a little bit of time on it because, to me, this is really trying to get grounded on sort of the difference between the supply side and the demand side of the equation with respect to renewables. So I'd like to take your attention first to the graphs. And for those of you who have eyesight even worse than mine, I hope you can see the ledger on this. But I want to take your attention. The blue bars on this graph are basically a reflection of the supply side of the equation. Okay, they're a reflection of projects that are either currently operating or under construction, and they generally reflect the fact that there are also several thousand megawatts of interconnection requests in regional transmission queues. This set of numbers, I think, is largely derived off the Bonneville queue, our interconnection queue, but I think they're maybe a bit more added on there. But if you look out to 2020, what you basically see is that between the current projects that are in the ground or under construction, and we know that we're starting today we will have 6,000 megawatts in the ground by the end of this year, that there's on the supply side about 14,400 megawatts of supply that's available out there. That's a pretty big number. And I know that not all under construction. Yes, I want to make that really clear that there's 6,000 megawatts by the end of the year, which will get us to the end of 2011, and then there are a whole bunch of additional projects, many of which have not even initiated construction, which are just in the interconnection queues and starting to have their requests processed. Okay, so that's the supply side of the equation. You know, and I think that we have, I know California ISO grapples with this. I was talking to Neil this morning. I think they have 68,000 megawatts of interconnection requests in the Cal ISO. We have multiple thousands of interconnection. I think I've heard other parts of the country. I think I once heard a number from MISO. It was something like 100,000 megs. So the supply side of the equation typically tends to reflect, you know, folks getting into interconnection queues and wanting to have a position to make sure that they have the opportunity to potentially get selected in an RFP or a different kind of process. But these are really, really big numbers, okay? And they don't necessarily reflect where the demand side of the equation is, right? So what we also try to do is, and this is reflected in the green line, if you take the council's assumptions in the sixth power plan about load growth in the region and you roll that out to 2020, and then you then apply the RPS percentages that are in the current laws that are on the books, okay, in Washington and Oregon and Montana, you come up with about 6,500 megawatts of demand
for renewable resources. And this is an assumption. Rachel's already pointed this out, okay, that you're doing it all with wind. Okay, so it's probably would need to take a little bit of haircut. But assuming you did it all with wind, you'd be looking at about 6,500 megawatts of wind energy in the Pacific Northwest by 2020. Okay, that's the green line. Then we know we are also being impacted.
Elliot, there's a question over here.
Sir. Yes, sir. Hey,
I'm sorry. Just a quick question. Do you have or can a notion how much of that 14,400 megawatts is proposed to be sited in, you know, Oregon, Washington, basically this side of the Rockies, and how much the other side?
I think from this particular graph, the vast majority of it, if not all of it on this side. Yeah, all of it. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. So we also know that the California RPS, which is a significant piece of public policy, is also having an impact on us. Right now, if you sort of look at 2011, the region, you know, we're in terms of the Pacific Northwest, the region is obviously well ahead of, in terms of installed capacity, what the current RPS targets are. We know that several of our utilities built in advance of the RPS targets, and there's quite a bit of selling of energy in RECs down to California now from some of our existing projects here in the Pacific Northwest. And there's going to be a little bit of a shuffling of the deck over the next few years as some of those projects are then sort of repatriated here to Northwest utilities, and California builds a little bit more and moves towards its long-term position. But what we're thinking, and again, this is kind of a base case, and this definitely has noise around it unequivocally, but we're thinking that the California utilities, given the policy that they've put out, which seems to be reasonably focused on exploring their own in-state capabilities, is likely to trend out at around 3,000 megawatts of long-term contracts over the next several years. Now, that again, I think we have to pay particular attention to that, and there's some big variables at play, but that's kind of our base case after having significantly scrubbed the California Public Utility Commission's website and all the information that they have about projects and talking quite actively to the California utilities. Neil will probably have a little bit of perspective on that. Those of you who've been watching the CAISO and have seen the kind of messaging coming out of there would say that they are fairly convinced that they've already identified enough transmission, even within the state of California, to get themselves to their 33% RPS targets. And they're looking like they're going to be very heavily focused on solar and wind within the state. And also Governor Brown, I understand, has put out a 12,000-megawatt distributed generation target within the state of California as well. So it's going to be interesting to watch. At an absolute minimum, I think things are going to have to kind of play themselves out for a few years down in California before you start seeing another big slug up here. This Caithness-Shepherd Flat project, this 800 or 900-megawatt project that's under construction right now, is going to be a huge addition to the mix in the Northwest. It's under contract to Southern California Edison. It's going to be questionable how much more of that we see in the short term. But the basic point I want to provide here is that you have a huge number on the supply side, okay, but it is at some point going to be constrained by, I think, the regulatory demand. Rachel points out to me frequently that there are other variables besides just RPS that are driving people to develop renewables. I acknowledge that point. I think it'll be interesting to see where gas prices go and where economics go. I think at this point, RPS appears to be certainly the biggest contributor to that demand. And so you're likely looking at a sort of a 10,000 megawatt 2020 number. And then this black line, this horizontal line that goes across the top there that intersects again, that's the amount of transmission capacity that the Bonneville Power Administration has sold over the last several years through three rounds of network open season and all of the long-term contracts that were signed prior to network open season. So as Steve Wright mentioned earlier, we've sold about 7,000 megawatts through NOS. Think about that. 7,000 megawatts of transmission have been sold through network open season. We've identified four critical network builds: John Day McNary, Big Eddy Knight, Lower Monumental, and the I-5 build to expand the Bonneville network, and tells you that we're likely to have a pretty good solid chunk of network transmission to get ourselves to 2020 on the Bonneville system. And I'm going to turn in a moment to some of the other builds, which are equally important. And so I think it raises some pretty interesting questions about where we are with respect to the demand for incremental transmission. But this is a very, very important thing. Let me briefly pause for a minute and see if there are any clarifying questions on this. Yeah, Don?
Well,
this is a good shot. I think that, and this is, I think, probably one of the fundamental questions that drives people's thoughts and emotions around all of the integration issues. There's a couple of, I'd make a couple of observations. One is the big growth in California demand between 2009 and 2012 looks like it goes from about 1,000 megawatts to about, I don't know, what is that, about 2,500 megawatts. The difference between the red and the green line looks awfully big given what we know about the structure of the California RPS and the deliverability requirements and the limitations of the intertie and how that all works together. And it's not, maybe for a later conversation,
yeah.
But that just looks high to me.
Okay.
The other thing is the blue bars, you know, anybody can go out and file for a permit. And there's a lot of, there's a lot of junk in the pipeline as you look at the supply of potential wind projects. And the third thing is every set of numbers, we look at this very hard also, and every set of numbers we look at says, you know, pretty much a leveling off at around 6,000 for the foreseeable future until we get into the middle part of the decade. You know, you largely see the RPS is fulfilled. I mean, if you look at utility behavior, just not here in the Northwest, but any place you have an RPS, what you consistently see is early compliance, which makes sense because utilities and their regulators want to see the customers getting the best deal that they can. And so they go out and they seek to find the best wind projects or the best solar projects. But, you know, what goes up must come down. So if you see early compliance, you're also going to see a lot less activity as you near the milestone. And I think that's what we're going to see. So I really do think that the region is in for a pretty significant breather when it comes to development.
Thanks, Don. Okay, well, let's keep moving on. Appreciate that. this next slide, this is a slide many of you may have seen. This is a slide of all the major Northwest, or many of the major Northwest proposed transmission projects. There's a couple key points I want to make. I've already mentioned the significant build-out in the Bonneville network that is occurring. There also are significant and very important projects that are being proposed and already construction underway in some cases on the Pacific Core system, the Gateway West project, very important project for reliability, native load, and renewable service. Idaho obviously working diligently on their Boardman-Hemingway strategy, and then PGE looking at the Cascades Crossing. So several of our major load-serving entities are also actively working on network builds, which will certainly help to get us to 2020 and likely beyond. There also is some IPP transmission development. This MATL line's going out of Montana up into Alberta. And there are a few other proposed projects, but the bottom line, I think, is that there is a significant amount of transmission. I think for BPA, you know, I think those of you who have been following this network open season process, I think the thinking is that this may be a pretty good time for just a little bit of a time out on that process to sort of take stock of the fundamentals, to consider some of the planning, credit, and financing aspects that are now beginning to give us a little bit of some challenges there, make sure that the sort of the risk proposition is still tenable, and to take a little bit of time to sort of to revisit that. And also just to remember another thing, which is that the utilities in the Northwest do appear to be focusing on the west side very heavily on the Washington-Oregon footprint in their IRPs. I've been one of the people who for years has been saying, boy, I really wish we were building a more geographically diversified wind fleet, you know, and we see all these wind coming in the lower Columbia, and it just seems to be adding up and adding up. But I think that what we're really seeing is that at the end of the day, I think economics are really constraining that. I think when you look at the IRPs, many of the utilities have looked at expanding outside of the Washington-Oregon footprint, and they're just not seeing it penciling out. Now, that said, we are now working pretty actively, certainly with folks in Montana. I think our latest network open season is giving a harder look at the Colstrip upgrade, and we'll be working on that. Whether or not that results in a longer-term, more significant build-out is another question. I think there, with respect to California, there does appear potentially to be some reasonably low-cost or at least modest cost to upgrade the existing DC lines, and there's some work underway on the northern intertie that I think is fairly compelling. But when it comes to the big intertie transmission expansion, particularly in California, it really raises this basic question. Is there a legitimate business case for big-time intertie expansion? And those of you who've seen this BOG report, this Brownfields Optimization Group report, we worked pretty heavily over the last couple of years, a kind of a small steering committee drawn from some Northwest utilities and the California parties, and we basically did a plan of service to see what it would take to expand the intertie transmission capacity between the Northwest and California by 3,000 megawatts. And the planners that did the work on that came up with some lines on the map that sort of a new line parallel to existing corridor across eastern Oregon down to the border, and then some upgrades of existing paths in California. At the end of the day, the price tag for that was about $5 to $6 billion for 3,000 megawatts of additional transmission capacity. And when we met most recently with some of the principals from California who have been fairly active up here, including PG&E and Edison and some of the Northern California Public, Smug and Tank, I would say that at the moment a $5 billion price tag for expanding the interties is not looking like a very compelling business opportunity. And I think it raises this question. We've been talking for quite a while about whether it's time to go out and do a big intertie open season. I think it's a question about whether the time is really prime for that yet to actually start trying to subscribe out these new lines given the kind of price tags we're seeing. So I think what we're sort of preparing ourselves for is a pretty substantial build out along the same kind of patterns we've been seeing so far, and we're going to have to prepare ourselves for dealing with the balancing and the oversupply and flexibility challenges with that fleet. So before we get to those three specific challenges, I want to mention one last thing, then turn it over to Ken with respect to the region's broader load resource balance, and that is this. And we've been looking at the big physical line in the air, but I know just as recently as last week, John Prescott from PNGC asked me a question. Are we thinking about the subgrid aspects of the transmission question, voltage stability, transient analysis? And I went back and just did a little bit more work, and I was pleased to see that actually on August 23rd, Bonneville's Technology Innovation Program is actually hosting a technical conference on that exact topic to really get on it. We're going to bring in a bunch of folks from the different utilities and really start saying, okay, we're kind of getting a handle on the line in the air questions. How are we doing with respect to some of the subgrid and the fast response type of issues? So John will definitely keep you and others posted on that. So I'm going to turn it over to Ken, who's going to take us through some looks in terms of broad load resource balance from the Northwest.
Thank you. So questions naturally arise about where the region is and its sort of load resource balance or resource adequacy look. Those aren't necessarily exactly the same things, but so we're providing here some of the information that's available to date. It isn't necessarily definitive or done, but it is a kind of the current look. This information on this slide is product of some work done by the Resource Adequacy Forum, which is another joint Bonneville and Council effort working closely with the PNUCC as well. And the information that's presented on this slide is for 2015 when they took a look at resource adequacy from kind of a probabilistic basis, this loss of load probability. And nominally, we're shooting for a standard of 5% at the moment. All of these things are kind of under review and reconsideration and other ways of doing it. But under the 5% standard, you can see in this table here that the numbers there represent loss load probabilities. They're all below 5% for 2015, indicating that under the current standard, the way we're currently looking at things, no need to panic about meeting peak loads or energy loads on a regional basis, either in the winter or the summer. Kind of another interesting thing, though, is although these numbers range from 0.5 to 1.9, a factor of essentially 4, actually, those aren't huge differences when you're looking at this kind of work. And it sort of indicates that we're about as energy short as we are, energy short or long, we're in about the same position with energy as we are in meeting peak hour load.
Ken, before you go on, there's a question from you.
Ken, is it fair to point out that
In those assumptions, it assumes a perfect market that all generation will turn on is available to the market and all transmission is available in order to move that generation.
Well, not quite. It does consider the availability of transmission imports from the south, but it's not it's limited more than just the intertie size. It's kind of a regional dialogue about what reasonable assumptions are there. And also, as you point out, there are merchant generators that are assumed available to the study, but not at the full availability of the project, not the full physical availability of the project. So, again, there's sort of a conversation that goes on about what the reasonable assumptions would be.
Just our operating experience has been that when you get into a very critical time in the marketplace, generators will or utilities will hold generation in reserve, so it's not always available. And the same thing goes with transmission.
Right.
We've run into emergency events where these numbers didn't exactly pan
right.
out.
And they may not. This is, again, a regional look and putting everybody in a pot. And some folks may be constrained by their access to market through transmission or other things as well. So I think that's a good point. Other questions? So this is another look, kind of a load resource balance courtesy of the PNUCC. On the left is the energy balance on an annual basis, showing us pretty flush with energy. If you look at January peak capability on the right, we see a fairly substantial short. Now, this look is different than the previous one in that it adds up what the utilities own. So the merchant projects, which there are about 3,000 megawatts of them, I think, in the region, don't show up here. And you can see, though, that there's about a 3,000 megawatt shortfall in January peak capability, but actually there's about a similar amount of energy shortage on a monthly basis there that doesn't show up when you look at an annual average number, but is there for January, I think January and February in the PNUCC numbers, which might be filled by purchases from other available generation, but it is a different look, and this is the kind of picture that utilities will look at and decide whether that or not they need for themselves to build that may or may not be needed if you looked at it regionally, as Jim was suggesting. Any questions on that before I go forward? Okay. So this is out of the council's sixth power plan, kind of looking forward. And the, this is a kind of an average over 750 scenarios that the council runs, looking at what the sort of expected build is. And you can see, it, most folks have probably seen this, that much of the load growth can be met by improved efficiency. The renewable resources there are primarily the RPS resources that the model's picking up. Absent the RPS, the model picks up some renewables as just being economic, but not quite as much as the RPS, and some gas plants there. There were some scenarios that the council looked at where we lost between 1,700 and 2,000 megawatt, average megawatts of coal generation in different ways, either through a CO2 tax or retirement of existing coal. And there's kind of a synopsis down there in the box on the lower right of what the model did in response. About 50% of the lost energy was made up by reducing exports out of the region. 17% of the energy was made up by increased use of existing gas plants. The model picked additional conservation programs to make up about 16%. There's a marginal increase in renewable energy, and about 18% of the energy was made up by building new gas generation. So it's kind of a look at maybe something close to the Centralia-Boardman issue and what the model at least thought was cost-effective from a regional perspective.
Thanks, Ken. Okay,
we're going to keep moving here. We're now going to try to dive in a little bit more into these three interrelated challenges of balancing over supply and system flexibility.
Hey, so Kelly, can I interrupt for just a
please.
Second? If I should have said this earlier, but we have about 75 people listening in on the phone to this conversation, and out of respect to them, if you could think to identify yourself briefly when you speak, that would just help them kind of get oriented. Thanks.
Okay, sure. So the balancing question is really this issue of how can we manage wind variability in a reliable, efficient manner while recognizing the limits on the region's hydro flexibility. The oversupply question, how can we reliably and equitably manage high hydro, high wind conditions, challenging emerging issue. And then finally, on the system flexibility side, how much do we actually have and how much will we need? So we're going to try to spend, I think as Steve Wright teed it up, those seem to be the three sort of principal areas that we are grappling with. From a system perspective, I want to take a tour on each of those. On the balancing side, I want to start out, you know, I know a lot of you have seen and talked about this, but I think there are varying levels of experience and maybe perhaps knowledge on some of this topic. So I want to just briefly reintroduce, this broad challenge of balancing is really one of trying to maintain load resource balance across multiple time horizons, right? All of our utilities are managing that load resource balance across the multiple years, the yearly, seasonal, monthly, daily, hourly, and even within the hour time horizon. And wind energy is primarily a challenge in the day ahead, hourly, and within hour time frames, okay? And there's sort of two frames of reference that are happening to think about the balancing challenge. The first concerns utilities that are purchasing wind that's physically located in their balancing authority and used primarily to serve their own native load. Okay, PacifiCorp is the classic example. These utilities need to manage the variability of wind across all of these relevant time horizons. They use the wind primarily as a source of fuel displacement, and they still need to carry their existing and contractual capacity resources in order to maintain load resource balance. And they may need over time to add additional flexibility resources to their system to manage the increased system variability and uncertainty created by wind. That's the sort of classic challenge of a load resource entity buying for their own service. Puget has some of that as well. Idaho, clearly, as well. Then there's the other situation, which is really the classic Bonneville case, where you've got a utility that has a large amount of wind interconnected to its system, but under contract to other utilities and other balancing authorities. These entities are primarily concerned with providing balancing capacity, that flexibility to move up and down, what we call inks and decks, in order to keep transmission schedules between the different balancing authorities whole during the hour. These entities are going to be less concerned with the hour-to-hour or day-ahead variations in wind output, since this, at the end of the day, must be managed by the receiving utilities, right? So there's really two different fundamental challenges, the load service and the big export play. At Bonneville, as we've seen in the last couple of years, the sheer quantity of wind interconnected to the system has begun to exhaust the physical capability of the federal dams to provide balancing capacity to support these firm hourly schedules of energy. And back in 2009, Bonneville actually implemented what's known as Dispatcher Standing Order 216, right? I'm going to put a graphic up here, and I'm going to focus on the curtailment side. Now, under DSO 216, actually, we both feather wind back to schedule or cut firm schedules during the hour when the unscheduled wind ramps are sufficient to exhaust available reserves. So periodically, as wind really overgenerates relative to schedule, you feather it back to schedule to maintain load resource balance when you don't have the reg down capability. But on the other side, if the wind falls off rapidly, BPA actually cuts the delivery schedules to the receiving balancing authorities, okay? So this occurs when that forecast error actually exceeds the quantity of reserves that Bonneville has agreed and planned to carry. This is a graphic of an example of a time when the wind was forecasted to be roughly around 2,000 megawatts or higher, and it dropped off very rapidly within the hour to an extent that we weren't able to make up all the difference with available ink reserves. We actually implemented a DSO 216 schedule curtailment and cut that schedule close to its actuals. Now, this requires the receiving balancing authorities to deploy their own reserves to make up the shortfall, because at the end of the day, you have to maintain load resource balance, right? Somebody's got to make up the difference. And if the hydro isn't sufficient in that situation to make it up, another set of resources has to pick up the difference. But this sort of situation has begun to call into question the sort of firmness of wind schedules. And at the end of the day, it really, really highlights the need for within our access to other sources of balancing capacity and a strategy for managing the tails of the wind output distribution. Okay, so there's really two things. One, you have to make sure that you've got access to available machine capacity in the hour so when the hydro system is tapped out, another resource can pick up the load. And also for those very, very, very extreme ramps, the ones that really only happen a handful of times over the course of the year, how do you deal with them? Some people, this argument is being played out at the Northwest Power Pool right now. Some people are arguing that you should take those really, really extreme wind ramps, on the downside and treat them as contingencies and have the reserve sharing pool deal with them, okay? Other people are saying, whoa, wait a minute. We put the reserve sharing pool together for a pretty good reason. It's responsible for managing contingencies and emergencies. Wind under generation doesn't look a lot like a contingency to me. We really better deal with that through balancing capacity and commercial transactions. There's actually, as you've seen in your background reading, it's called the Combined Reserves Task Force at the Power Pool that's really trying to figure out how to deal with this. And, you know, is it zero events that qualify for contingency reserve treatment? Well, maybe not, but is it a lot of events? No. And somewhere in between maybe 30 hours a year and zero, there may be a sweet spot. We have to figure out how to nail that and get clarity because you need clarity around your business rules. And that issue is really being played out. But this issue, I really want to highlight this because this is really the core of the apple here in terms of the within-hour operation is this access issue is really a big issue. We need to be able to maintain reliability inside the hour while also enabling the market to function effectively. This really is one of our most pressing challenges as we get bigger and as we scale up towards 10,000 megawatts. I'm going to talk about the many things we're doing to try to address this, okay? So let's move on to the next slide. And as I mentioned, you know, I really look out, and I got to tell you that I really do feel that this region has come a long way in 4 years in addressing this issue. And I think, as I said earlier before, there's a lot of good work that's going on at our utilities. One of the most important developments that's happened is we've really raised the bar in terms of our understanding of the importance of wind forecasting and state awareness. Ken has actually been a person who's just continuously hammered that point home to significant benefit to try to improve the, you know, if you have a better forecast and you can reduce that control error, that really directly reduces your balancing reserve obligation, okay? The other thing is next month, literally July 2011, this region is going live with 30-minute intra-hour scheduling. A significant fraction of the region's utilities are going to be implementing these common business practices. We're putting a new trading platform in place called the Intra-Hour Transaction Accelerator Platform that's also going to be supplemented with a dynamic scheduling system to allow for fast trade on dynamic products between these balancing authorities. This is a very, very important and meaningful development for this region. I think it's going to be very interesting to see how it plays out. The joint initiative of Columbia Grid NTTG and WestConnect has led the charge on this and has done a brilliant job bringing people together and collaborating around this. I think it's a poster child for the kind of stuff we need to be doing in this region to address these problems. And so that's going live next month. At Bonneville, we are actually, to try to help support this nascent market, we're actually offering a committed intra-hour scheduling product in our next rate case, which will give people a significant discount off their balancing charge if they agree to schedule on a 30-minute basis. Okay, so we're trying to create incentives for that. And then another very, very important development that eventually is designed to try to reduce the demand for federal balancing capacity is the Iberdrola self-supply pilot. Some of you have likely seen presentations from Don and Kevin and Laura Bean and others. Iberdrola is self-supplying their generation imbalance reserves in our system, and they've been doing a pretty darn good job of it, and this pilot is very interesting. As a matter of fact, when you look really at the heart of this thing, what these guys are basically doing is running a little imbalance market inside the Bonneville footprint, okay, and we are helping them to try to increase the liquidity in that market, and they're doing a really good job. We've got, you know, a number of the utilities around this table are selling to Iberdrola, earning revenue doing that, and it's a very interesting pilot. Now, the question is, how does that thing evolve over time? And really, as we evaluate the pilot, I think the broader question is, how would you apply this type of a framework more broadly to the needs of the Bonneville Balancing Authority or potentially groups of balancing authorities to get maximum portfolio economics, right? I mentioned the Power Pool Combined Reserve Task Force. looking at the issue of contingency reserve treatment. Bonneville and Northwestern are both entities that are looking at potentially third-party supply purchases of balancing reserves from the market. I wanted to mention this WSPP effort. The WSPP group has submitted two product schedules to FERC, which will help increase the liquidity in the market for these types of energy and capacity products. And then there's the very, I think, very interesting proposal that's being currently evaluated at WEC for this energy imbalance market. I know a lot of you around this table are paying attention to this dialogue. We're all waiting, I think, anxiously to see the results of the cost-benefit analysis for this study that's coming out on June 22nd. There's going to be a significant amount of effort to sort of do the post-processing on this cost-benefit analysis to see how it looks, to see if this kind of a structure might add considerable value above and beyond the things we're doing with the inter-hour markets. There are, I think, a couple things to remember. You know, potentially great benefits of the inter-hour markets. The one thing it doesn't necessarily do, inter-hour scheduling, is doesn't leverage the diversity in loads and wind between the different balancing authorities. An energy imbalance market might do that and substantially reduce the overall balancing requirement. Also, the inter-hour scheduling does not do an economic dispatch of the resources. So the EIM, the energy imbalance market, would be designed to take that to the next step. It's going to be, I think, a very, very interesting summer and fall as the balancing authorities continue to discuss this and see if there's really a value proposition there and see if it's the kind of thing we want to put a shoulder to. Last couple things, a lot of work on dynamic transfer, being able to move signal between the balancing authorities and do it without problems in the subgrid is very important. Again, the Columbia Grid Wind Integration Study Team has convened a group of our best study engineers to see how much dynamic transfer we have and what it's going to take to really expand that. ACE diversity is still moving after a couple of hiccups with compliance, but they sorted that out. I know Northwestern and Idaho and others are still actively engaged in ADI, getting real benefits out of there. The RBC pilot across the interconnection is underway. And we are really also, that's a lot of gen side, we're also really starting through the smart grid and demand side efforts to try to get a real handle on what the flexibility resource is on the load side of the equation. Bonneville is running a few pilots. The council is very involved in that, taking a look at hot water heaters and refrigeration units, you name it. There's potentially a significant amount of flexibility on the demand side. I think we're actually till 11:20.
Hey, Elliot?
Yes.
You want to, like, take a breath for a second?
Yes.
And can we have a round of applause for all the good things that are going on?
Round of applause to the Pacific Northwest and to colleagues across the interconnection. Yeah. Yes.
Elliot, John Savage, Oregon PUCs. So we have all these activities. Actually, I'm not going to applause right quite yet. So we have all these activities. I guess the question is, have we done any work where we really identified what we get if we are successful with most or all of these? And second of all, how do we know we're successful with most or all of these? What metrics are we using, say, for dynamic scheduling or intra-hour scheduling or use of ITAP?
I think certainly total reserve requirement is one of the metrics. Total economic dispatch costs is another one of the metrics. Those are going to be looked at in the cost-benefit analysis. Total wind integration rates, I think, will be another metric. So I don't think I have a perfect answer, but those are the right questions. And I think that the cost-benefit analysis that's coming out of WEC is going to really force people to really drill into that. Yeah. Okay. Ken is nudging me. We do have to keep moving. We've only got about 15 minutes before Paul pulls out the hook. So I think we're going to get there because that really, the balancing stuff, but we want to turn our attention now to the oversupply issue. So I'm not going to spend a ton of time on the detail on this. I know there's a lot of thinking going on the oversupply issue right now. Clearly, big hydro runoff is not a new phenomenon for this region. It's been with our system for years and years, but this new dynamic of high hydro and high wind sort of coinciding with the total dissolved gas limitations has clearly created a very complex and controversial operational and cost allocation issue. I can say that I've only been working at Bonneville for 9 years, which isn't long in Bonneville years, but I haven't seen many more anguished decisions coming out of BPA than this environmental redispatch issue. This one has, I know, torn a lot of people up and sort of tried to pull every trick out of our hats before putting this thing on the table. But at the end of the day, it's out there. And so this interim environmental redispatch policy is certainly providing a short-term physical solution to the problem, But it obviously has financial impacts, I will in just a moment, on wind generators. And I think I would hope we all share a common interest in finding a sustainable and equitable long-term solution of the problem. So what I want to try to do is I want to basically answer a couple of questions. What's been the experience with environmental redispatch to date? How can we think about the potential economic impacts? And how big is the problem likely to get over time? So here's a few numbers. So as you know, the first thing we do with environmental redispatch is we actually curtail down the non-variable resources in Bonneville's control area. And so since this ER went into place May 18th, we've had about 6,350 megawatt hours of reduced generation for non-wind rate resources. But the remaining non-variable generation, our balancing authority, has really been around 100 megawatts out of 7,000 megawatts nameplate. We have significant, I think any of you who've watched, looked at the data on our website, we've really been able to get the vast, vast majority of the thermal off the system. Environmental redispatch has been implemented nightly since May 18th, except for May 25th and June 1st. We've had about 55,235 megawatt hours of wind generation been replaced by Federal Hydro since May 18th. That comes out to about 15% of the wind generation has been reduced due to environmental redispatch during this period. And this has been primarily a what we call a graveyard hour problem. It's been happening from about 12 o'clock at night till 5 or 6 in the morning, typically between 4 to 7 hours per night. And, of course, the economic impacts of this really vary by entity. You know, obviously, for BPA, not paying negative prices. Entities that have REC and PTC exposure are eating that. Some, we understand that some of the utilities or some of the off-takers and wind generators may have contract exposures, which they're unable to substitute hydro for wind. This is a real problem for them and something that is clearly going to need to be addressed. I want to have Ken take us through briefly what he thinks the magnitude of the oversupply. This is based off the council's oversupply paper.
Yeah, thanks. This is a chart right out of the oversupply paper that's still in draft form, but most of you may have seen this. I removed the vertical axis title on purpose. It used to say hours per year because model that was used to create this information really doesn't have a detailed hydro model in it. So we're really just looking at how this is done by the Aurora model. What it we sort of took an index of these events, and you can see that the likelihood of the events really increased, or the severity, I guess, of the events increased pretty substantially from 2008. Through to about 2010, sort of leveling off, forecast anyway in the model to sort of drop a little bit in 2013 as we hope and I guess expect the loads to kind of recover out of the economic recession and begin to grow again. The middle line there is really meeting the Northwest RPS, and the line on top is if there's additional wind, another 3,000 megawatts added above the Northwest RPS, ostensibly perhaps to meet California RPS. So you can see that the events will, in the Northwest RPS scenario at least, don't change a huge amount from where they are today, at least according to this model. There is more detailed work being done now with the council's Genesis model in conjunction with PNUCC and the Resource Adequacy Forum, looking at not only more detail about what the hydro system can do, but also ultimately some issues around flexibility and how that might come into play.
Ken, you're assuming a normal hydro year in all these?
In this chart, yeah, we have the scenario. The question is whether we're assuming normal hydro. This chart is normal hydro, but we have some other charts in there that show the effect of the range of hydro conditions, and also a chart that shows at least pricing effects over months of the year instead of annual averages.
So in terms of work that's underway or needs to get underway to deal with this, obviously we're going to continue to try to develop a better understanding. We're working our way through our first real spring of this, paying a lot of attention to it, trying to get a handle on how big the problem is, what the dollars are, et cetera. And I think we clearly need to continue the short-term measures that can reduce the need for environmental redispatch. I think we've been trying to do everything we can to maximize displacement of thermal generation. In conversations with folks throughout the interconnection, trying to make that every last megawatt of thermal generation that can be off the system is off. We're going to, there's probably even additional dialogue that could happen on that topic. But from our perspective, certainly in our balancing authority, the resources that we control, they've been off, and we'll continue to look. Obviously, optimizing transmission maintenance schedules is important. During the off-peak hours, when environmental redispatch has actually been happening, we've been finding that typically the interties down in California have not been loaded up, and that's primarily because California's had their own oversupply challenges. But to the extent to which we can keep the transmission lines loaded up in heavy load hours, that allows us to generate as much as possible, which minimize the amount of water that you have to move at night. Working closely with the Corps and the Bureau of Canada to try to maximize storage draft flexibility. And then really, I think the most important thing right now is try to maintain open communication through our Friday spring operations call and other, just getting people together, keep putting our heads together and to see if there's ways to address the issue. I think something that's clearly going to be needed is an evaluation of other suggested physical market and institutional alternatives. I think both Steve and Tom talked about potentially taking a look and maybe building out a supply curve of what some of these longer-dated physical options might be, everything between intertie transmission, storage and load control, more pumping load, even something like resistive dummy load banks, which probably needs to be on the table. And then, again, at the end of the day, encouraging diverse wind or non-wind renewable resource development. So all these are going to be some of the physical solutions. I think the council's paper sort of characterized it quite well. You're going to be looking at two potential paths. There's going to be physical, potentially expensive, longer-dated solutions, which may or may not address the issue. And then there may be quicker sort of legislative or cost allocation approaches, which may have political risks. And so I think those are the two paths that we're looking at, and I'm just hoping that the region will continue to rally. I just wanted to mention one quick thing. There is a relationship between the balancing issues and the oversupply issues. Some people have said that, well, if you just get a big, you know, imbalance market or, you know, broader kind of controller consolidation, that that'll solve this issue. My perspective is that it'll nibble at it. It'll help. It will definitely potentially move some of the reserve obligation off the hydro system, get a little bit more of an optimization. But I don't think it's a panacea. I think it's, at the end of the day, you've got a physical oversupply issue between a ton of hydro and a ton of wind. And I think that you just have to address that. But again, totally open to these other physical solutions, but I don't think that that one on its own is going to solve this, make this issue go away. And then I think the question of dissolved gas, we haven't seen anything yet that tells us that moving from Washington to an Oregon standard is going to make a huge difference in terms of the magnitude of the problem. But we'll continue to dialogue on these things. I want to I'm sure that this topic will play out a little bit more across the course of the day. I want to make just a couple last points.
Elliot, Bill Drummond had a question.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Elliot, is new intertie transmission really a likely alternative? I thought I heard you say earlier that didn't appear to be particularly attractive.
Yeah, I think if you built the supply curve and you're focused specifically on this issue, it's probably on the very, very high end of the cost side, so unlikely. Yeah, thanks, Bill. Okay, so the last topic area is flexibility adequacy. I can wrap this up in just a couple minutes so we can get into the more interactive part of the program. On the flexibility side, when we first kicked off the Wind Integration Action Plan four years ago, there was a lot of concern about how much capacity value wind had. You know, remember that? We had a provisional 15% capacity value target for wind. And we had a lot of questions about that. And so the council has actually really taken that issue on. I think that the council, PNUC, and the utility is now squarely aware that wind provides very little capacity value to the system. This basic learning is now being captured through the Resource Adequacy Forum and other planning mechanisms. Okay, so I think we've got a pretty good handle on that issue. Wind is primarily an energy and displacement resource. It doesn't provide a lot of peaking capacity. I think we kind of get that. As the wind fleet scales up, however, the demand for flexibility will continue to increase. I think inter-hour scheduling and potentially an energy imbalance market will dampen that growth curve, but ultimately new flexibility resources may be needed. So this broader question of flexibility adequacy, does the system have the capability to ramp up and down and provide supplemental energy to manage the variability of the growing wind fleet is another issue that's definitely becoming increasingly important. So the last couple of slides here try to depict that. This is, again, drawn from the Bonneville system, but certainly from our perspective, and I would look forward to hearing from the other folks in the room about what they're seeing on their systems. But on the Bonneville side, certainly the absolute magnitude of ramps on the Bonneville system is increasing. Although we are seeing a little bit of diversity value, the ramping as a percentage of the installed wind capacity is declining a bit as the fleet builds out. But that you can see on the 30-minute time frame, we've seen 1,120 megawatt ramps in 30 minutes on the upside, 1,580 in the 60-minute time frame, and then the wind fleet is ramped down as much as 937 megawatts in 30 minutes and as much as 1,161 megs in an hourly basis. Those are significant ramps, and this is why the balancing challenge is something we want to really pay careful attention and stay focused on. And this graph just generally shows that as we continue to scale up the wind fleet, the amount of inks and decks that we will need is likely to continue to increase. Now, this graph is based off of 30-minute persistence forecasting with 60-minute scheduling. I think as we move towards 30-minute scheduling and potentially an EIM, this will definitely, these lines will be clipped, and I think we're still working to figure out exactly how much diversity value there is in the fleet. So those lines are I think, our best shot at it right now. We're going to continue to evaluate that. But this increase in balancing reserves as the wind fleet grows is a phenomenon that's going to be with us. So there are going to continue to be quite a bit of work underway to address this issue. The Northwest Resource Adequacy Forum is evaluating the contribution of wind to regional reliability and is actually developing a flexibility adequacy metric. You know, the PNUC System Planning Committee recently put out this review of capacity, energy, and flexibility definitions and planning requirements. We really realize that the traditional metrics that we've used for resource adequacy of capacity and energy now need to be supplemented with a flexibility metric because it's another part of sufficiency for reliability. We've seen that the utilities are beginning to explicitly address flexibility requirements in their IRPs. I know several weeks back I saw Jim Lobdell and Stephen Brown make a very good presentation on how their IRP is beginning to address flexibility. The actual turbine manufacturers are beginning to respond with more flexible and efficient natural gas generators to start thinking about flexibility requirements. And then, of course, the smart grid and demand response initiatives that the region's undertaking are really beginning to look for flexibility on the load side of the equation. So this is going to be an issue that's going to be with us, and there's potentially a significant amount of untapped potential in our existing both generation and load fleet. So I guess if there were four key takeaways to leave you with from this presentation that Ken and I thought were essential. The first is that with the region already approaching 6,000 megawatts, the potential supply of additional wind energy significantly exceeds total 2020 RPS demand of 10,000 megs. I think the region appears to have identified and subscribed the necessary transmission builds to support RPS for 2020 and likely beyond. The economics of large-scale intertie expansion are questionable, certainly going to need more analysis, but some of the numbers that have been on the table right now raise some questions there. And this springtime oversupply issue is certainly our most acute challenge today, and we need to stay focused on resolving it now, but the efficient provision of balancing services will require continued coordinated and focused attention. And certainly I think we had, I think, one round of applause during the presentation. That's good. I'd like to at least end it on a positive note, and that is that certainly while there are unequivocally some challenges we're facing, they don't necessarily appear to be insurmountable if we continue to work together, build on our considerable momentum, and address them together. So with that, I will close our section, and we'll look forward to the next part of the panel.
Any other clarifying questions for Elliot?
Okay, hearing none. So we're going on to the kind of the learning from each other part of the agenda, and Elliot's invited four panelists. We're briefly going to really bounce off what Elliot just said, sort of supplement what he said, disagree with things maybe, or add from there. But fundamentally, we're trying to learn from each other here. So we have four invited speakers who have thought about this, have brief reflections on this.
While they're speaking, I'd also like to ask the steering committee members to gather their own thoughts about, again, what would you add to what Elliot put on the table about, again, not solutions at this point, but what have you experienced in your own realm that you want to make sure others know to set the stage for our action planning discussion later this afternoon. So gather your thoughts about that. I'm not going to force all of you to speak on that, but I'd really like to get the it's important for us to get on the same basis of knowledge before we start talking about solutions. So, Elliot, you want to lead off here?
Good morning, everyone. Stefan Bird with PacifiCorp. I'm responsible for our commercial and trading organization, which manages part of our balancing authority operations in the East and the West. And I think Elliot, as usual, has done a very good job of laying out, the lay of the land and the issues that are before us. I also appreciate Steve Wright's comments on the front, and I certainly agree with those three highlighted areas of balancing, undersupply issues, oversupply issues. I would add one more to that, though, which is market rules, which really overlay all three of those areas, and I think that's very important for the group as a whole to also consider as we talk about, each of those fundamental three areas that physically have to be addressed. Just a quick overview for PacifiCorp again. As Elliot noted, we have about 2,000 megawatts of wind in our balancing authority. We have about just under 200 megawatts in BPA's system. And through that experience, we do deal with a lot of the very same challenges that BPA addresses. We've got situations of oversupply. We ensure that we've got flexible resources there to balance no matter what, so we can deal with an undersupply situation and high ramps. We have the ability to curtail, and we do curtail when necessary because transmission situations limit us. We have hydro systems, and so we operate under restrictions related to those licenses and all the environmental guidelines that we follow. And so we certainly are empathetic to a lot of the same challenges that the Bonneville Power Administration faces. I think looking ahead in our IRP, which we recently published, we show a need in our preferred portfolio for just over 2,000 megawatts on top of the 2,000 that I just mentioned, so roughly doubling over our IRP timeframe. And that could certainly vary quite a bit depending on what the future holds, and we talk about a lot of different scenarios in our IRP. But with the group here just focusing perhaps on Oregon, Washington, California, for those states alone with our renewable portfolio compliance standards, in particular Oregon, which triggers up to 25% by 2025, over the long term, that is really a very important focus point for us on how we'll maintain compliance in these western states. In addition, in Washington, we have a limitation on where we can acquire those resources. And again, with the restrictions and issues that we've talked about this morning, that certainly affects our costs. And again, we're a slightly different stake in the game as a utility. Our focus is on supplying the least cost reliable power to our customers while maintaining compliance certainly with all requirements. So looking ahead, again, we see that challenge as primarily resolved through transmission. And so as Pat Wright, who's here today, may speak later, our Energy Gateway project is critical not only for load serving requirements and reliability, but it also provides access to the lowest cost renewables in our system. And so we've been very active in pushing that project forward over the last several years and continue to look forward to bringing online, I think it's a couple thousand miles of additional transmission with tremendous access to renewables. Per my earlier comments on market rules, I think, maybe the elephant in the room with the environmental redispatch issue and so forth, we take issue with that because, we see that as a transfer of value basically from our customers to some other customer class, and we disagree with that interpretation of the market rules. So that's something that will have to be addressed in the proper forum. I think looking forward, again, we're in a situation where we manage a balancing authority, and when we're working with the Bonneville Power Administration to take out our assets, which are currently in their balancing authority, and move those to our balancing authority, so we would no longer be subject to the environmental redispatch nor the DSO 216. And again, we have the flexible resources to manage those assets and balance them, we think, at a lower cost without that problem. But long term, we still have a stake in this game. As I mentioned, with our renewable portfolio standard and our general view in our IRP, to add more resources. And so we don't see those new resources coming online without new transmission, frankly, whether that's in the east or the west. But we'll have to weigh very carefully the costs of adding those resources as they get bid into our request for proposals, whether they're in BPA system or in our territory where we might have to add transmission directly to serve load. So over the long term, those are going to be the very important questions for PacifiCorp. But on the positive note, I would certainly agree with Elliot. I think it's been a tremendous collaboration amongst the region on all the balancing initiatives. I think they will have a significant impact in reducing the amount of reserves that we have to carry. They don't solve the oversupply problem, but from a standpoint of day-to-day managing the reserves with that intermittent wind in particular, I think those are all very important initiatives, and we'll start to see results here even this summer. So thank you for everyone that's been participating and contributing to that effort. So I'll stop with those comments and happy to answer any questions after my colleagues speak.
Okay, thanks. So next we have Dana Tolson with Snohomish.
Good morning. My name is Dana Tolson. I am the Assistant General Manager at Snohomish PUD in charge of the Power Division. And I wanted to give you a little bit of Snohomish perspective, but first, I wanted to tell you a little bit about who we are, and then that will inform you as to why we have these perspectives. When you walk in the lobby at Snohomish PUD, it says, your Northwest Renewables Utility. So that's who we are. Long before I even knew what global climate change was, the commissioners were worried about greenhouse gases and have given us the directive that all future load growth will be met, of course, first with conservation, but then with renewables, and that means non-carbon renewables, no gas at all in our resource mix. So in 2007, we went out to try to fulfill that need as we were seeing quite a bit of load growth, and we purchased 220 megawatts of wind through an RFP. And one of the things we learned is that when you ask for renewables, there's a few little bits of biomass. There might be 2 or 3 megawatts of small hydro in your backyard. But if you really have a need to meet load growth long term, you're looking at wind. We are, of course, looking at tidal energy in our backyard, which is very small. And we're also looking at geothermal resources. But if we do not find those geothermal resources, we will be adding or doubling the wind to our fleet to meet our 2020 RPS as well as our load growth. So wind is in our future as well as in our current situation. I also can't tell you about Snohomish PUD without saying that we are Bonneville's single largest customer. Everyone smiles. But what that means is that when we look at Bonneville's revenue requirement and their rates, Snohomish pays 10% of it. It's a really easy number metric. Whenever the rates go up by $100 million, we pay $10 million. We purchase the block and slice product, and that's important because we use slice to integrate wind on an hour, two-hour basis. We rely on Bonneville within an hour. And the other defining factor is that we are a preference customer. We are the single largest preference customer, and that means we have a special relationship with Bonneville. We think of the federal system as our system, and Bonneville is part of our family. Of course. That said, we are not a BA, a balancing authority. We are within Bonneville's balancing authority, and I want you to know what that means. It means that 30 minutes after the hour, we tell BPA what our wind schedule will be and what our slice and block schedule will be. We pay for wind integration within the hour, and we pay for all other ancillary services. We forecast our own wind, although we do for one project, the wind is forecasted by the vendor. And we try to forecast that as accurately as possible because, of course, we pay gen imbalance charges. From 1 hour to the next hour, we meet those changes in the wind output by adjusting our slice product to the extent that it's flexible enough to allow us to do that. Otherwise, we go to the market to
to buy or sell to balance against our load line. So that's what our schedulers do every hour. It can be a wild ride at times. So I tell you this because I want you to know that Snohomish then has a foot in both camps very firmly, both on the wind integration side, the wind side, and on BPA side. We want our BPA's rates to be as low as possible, but we also want wind integration rates to be fair, and we want a healthy and vibrant wind industry because we rely on that wind industry for our future. So we have this symbiotic relationship going on with both parties. And all this relationship become even more important as we grow and as the I-937 2020 targets kick in. So all that said, we view the federal hydro system and its capability of balancing and integrating wind as a limited resource, a resource that needs to be managed on a sustainable basis for meeting loads and wind integration. And although all of these technical fixes may stretch the capability of the system and allow us to integrate more wind, at some point in time we're going to reach those limits. And we're worried about a modern-day tragedy of the commons. By following self-interest, each villager adds another cow to the field to graze until the cow degrades the grass so much that we destroy the field for everyone. And we think that we don't have to go there, that with each new wind project, unfortunately, we'll put pressure on the FCRPS and raise wind integration rates when Bonneville ends up having to add more expensive resources like pump storage or gas turbines in order to fulfill these balancing obligations. But that puts pressure on prices for all projects, not just the new ones, but for the existing projects. And those existing projects could become harmed. And for us, that's problematic because we want healthy partners with our existing vendors, and we want to make sure that they're there for the 15- and 20-year contracts that we have signed with them. So we look at the FCRPS as a resource that binds us as a community, and it is one that needs rules and breaks around it so that we can manage it sustainably and that we can recognize all of our different interests, our preference rights. We can recognize the existing projects and then give price signals to new projects that may be thinking about this new field. Very similarly, I look at the regional dialogue as the same kind of question about a limited resource that has to be managed for the greater good of all, which requires some departure from market signals, but requires a two-step rate design process. I think these are avenues worth exploring. I don't have all the answers, obviously. But again, we've got a great history of working together on solutions to problems that affect all of us. And this particular gathering, I think, is an example of that. And we will, I'm sure, actually come up with a solution that works for everyone.
Thanks a lot, Dana. Again, we're going to hold questions until all four of the panelists are done. Laura Bean.
Good morning. My name is Laura Bean. I'm manager of regulation and market structure for Iberdrola Renewables, and I'm also the project manager for our self-supply pilot that Elliot mentioned. I just have a couple of comments that I will make in response to Elliot's presentation. First, Don already touched on kind of tempering the growth expectations, and I guess I would just add to that, Elliot mentioned that there was a pretty significant chunk of merchant generation that exists today, merchant wind generation. Iberdrola Renewables owns 350 megawatts of that merchant generation that is not under long-term power purchase agreements. And I think it's a very difficult PPA market today. I think if you layer in some of these business practices like Dispatcher Standing Order 216, environmental redispatch, it just adds a lot of uncertainty to the product that can be delivered. And I think that's going to further temper some of those growth projections for wind. Second, I'll just make a couple of comments about the self-supply pilot. It did go live in October of last year. I know many of you have heard us around the circuit, running around making presentations about how it's going. In March and April of this year, the pilot's performance really began to suffer. That's primarily a result of insufficient balancing resources, and for a variety of reasons that aren't appropriate to go into today, we were unable to add new balancing resources, and so we were unable to perform in the way that we needed to, which resulted in it being much less cost effective than we had forecasted and also than we really needed it to be. And then, of course, in the last couple of weeks with environmental redispatch, during light load hours, the way that DSO 216 and environmental redispatch are kind of being interchanged there, the reserves have been reduced, which is triggering DSO 216 events pretty much all night long. As you can imagine, it's become very difficult for our dispatchers to be able to self-supply and balance and even figure out which way is up half the time during those hours. So it's a little too early to see how the performance of the pilot will be, but I'm guessing that the performance will also suffer during May and June. On a positive note, Bonneville did re-engage with us about 8 weeks ago, and we have been able to add additional resources as recently as last week. So I think as soon as we get through this difficult period that the region's facing, I think we'll see much better performance under the pilot, and we're very hopeful and excited about that. And just finally, I just think it's important to acknowledge or just maybe point out, Elliot mentioned that during virtually all of these events for environmental redispatch, there is capability on the ties. Those ties are open. And that just seems clear to me that this really is an economic issue, not really an environmental or fish issue. Thanks.
Thanks, Laura. Dave Mills.
I'm the Director of Energy Supply and Planning for Puget Sound Energy. Thanks to the Council and Bonneville for hosting the event, for Elliot for inviting me to speak on the panel, and I guess if I'm well-behaved, I might be invited back. Puget has a unique position with respect to wind resources. I kind of call it the three legs of the stool or the triple crown. We have Hopkins Ridge, 157-megawatt wind plant that's in Bonneville's balancing authority. We have been analyzing and assessing what it would take to have us relocate that into the Puget Balancing Authority, and suffice it to say that the current environmental redispatch is adding some very necessary data points for that analysis. We also have a 270-megawatt wild horse plant that's in the Puget Balancing Authority, and then the third leg of the stool is we have about 120 megawatts of third-party in the Puget BA as well. So different, every one of those managed very differently, relying on potentially different resources. And, then, of course, the third-party wind integration attribute is a FERC jurisdictional issue, which also has some interesting nuances as well. In addition to managing the company's merchant trading operations, I'm also responsible for producing the company's integrated resource plan. We just submitted that plan to the UTC last week. A quick review of that plan will indicate that the resource choice is renewables in time to meet the 15% 2020 RPS standard, complemented by a significant amount of peaking resources, both to meet the capacity needs of our customer demand, as well as to provide wind integration services as our hydro position is dwindling over time. A few disclaimers here, or I guess points of agreement. Earlier it was made comment that it was the RPS that was driving the acquisition of these renewable resources in advance of need. Our analysis actually indicates it's the tax credit treatment, not so much the RPS. These machines, specifically wind machines, are fairly quick to put up as long as there's transmission available. And furthermore, I'd say that the regulated utilities specifically are not likely to build in surplus of that RPS need. And that sort of dovetails with Iberdrola's comments and other comments here about that we may actually see a leveling off of here. There's been a big jump in acquisitions and building to meet that need, and a lot of it's been done in advance. And that kind of dovetails into the theme of my comments is I worry about what we're building here to solve this problem, and I worry that we might be targeting a trajectory and an endpoint that may be outside of the headlights. But I think it's our responsibility as utility regional leaders
to be able to better or at least clearly articulate an end state and, more importantly, what of these various initiatives are going to drive us towards meeting that end state. I get very concerned. We met about 15 months ago. We talked about the myriad number of balancing initiatives, many of which have been talked about here this morning. I think my comment there was, wow, that's a lot of initiatives. I'm not sure how they're all going to come together, and the specific challenges, the number of balancing authorities represented in this region. And as one example, to get us all of the schedule at the same scheduling interval would be a very difficult challenge. I'd also worry that those embryonic or foundation building balancing initiatives, we tend to get distracted from them by other new initiatives that come down the pike. And one here I'm thinking of is the Efficient Dispatch Toolkit and the energy imbalance market, which feel more like the other end of the continuum, more like an end state rather than the foundation building initiatives to get us there. And then lately, over the last several weeks, we all have been very distracted with environmental redispatch, which hopefully is an interim measure as we seek to find a better solution to what I'll call a package or a more coordinated objective that deals with both the balancing, the need for flexible resources, and the overgeneration. That's the end of my comments.
Thanks, Dave. We've got folks here from California. I'd really like if you all would be willing to make a few comments and come up to the chair here, just so folks can hear you on the phone if you need on the speaker.
Hello. My name is Neil Miller with the California ISO. Thank you for the chance to say a few things. First off, I just wanted to start by pointing out that I thought Elliot did a wonderful job providing a lot of context for what's happening in California. I would say that if there are people that are clear on the path forward, then they haven't been paying attention, because we do have a number of moving parts within the state, both on the renewable portfolio standards, the goals for distributed generation, as well as a fairly significant expected fleet replacement on once-through cooling thermal units, especially in the LA Basin area. So there are a lot of moving parts, and that's really led us to develop what we were calling our least regress approach, a portfolio analysis approach, looking at a wide range of scenarios for how the generation in the state could evolve. And that does include a fairly wide range of possibilities for out-of-state generation as well. In our last transmission plan, we were evaluating anywhere from 2,000 to 7,500 megawatts of out-of-state generation. Our base planning scenario was in the 3,000, 3,500 megawatt range, which I think was also consistent with Elliot's observations. But I don't want a center point or a midpoint to be picked as the final answer just because it happens to be in the middle. There will be considerable work going on in California to sort some of these issues out and to land on what ultimately moves forward. But I do think that the overview you heard today about the range of possibilities and where in the near term some of these issues seem to be going was quite valid, so I won't bother reiterating that. So I think that's all I'll say for now. I'll be around through the rest of the day or if there are other questions.
Great. Thanks. Just stay there for a moment. Mark Ulrich, are you now on the phone?
I am. Can you hear me?
Barely. Can we
push him up? Hi, it's Mark Ulrich from Southern California Edison.
We can hear you well.
Okay, good. I did want to give a little bit of context of the new renewable bill in California and its impact on procurement. All three utilities have launched a new solicitation. We'll be looking for in and out-of-state renewables. But the new bill deters out-of-state renewables significantly. The other thing that the bill does is it takes renewable energy excess that we've had, and we've had to apply that excess backwards. Now we can apply that excess forward. So it makes us a lot less hungry for renewables. We'll be looking for, at least at Edison, late decade online dates per renewables. So I think for the next 5 to 7 years, we'll be focused just on renewables that we've already executed transactions for and only be doing additional out-of-state transactions for deals that are extremely attractive. And that's about it.
Okay, thanks a lot. Dave, did you want to? I'm sorry. Yeah. Did you want to throw anything in here? Dave Dockham?
Oh,
I'm sorry. Excuse me, I thought it was going to.
Sorry, I plan to come to listen today, but listening to some of the comments of Elliot, I was thinking there were a couple of things I might be able to share that might help shed some light on California's interest in out-of-state renewables.
I think Dave was with NCPA.
Yeah, sorry. I'm with the Northern California Power Agency. I'm assistant general manager there for power supply. And there are two reports that are published annually and semi-annually in California by the California Energy Commission, one, the Integrated Energy Policy Report, and the second, the Strategic Transmission Investment Study. And both of those provide detailed information on kind of the state of utilities compliance with the Renewable Portfolio Standard and identified transmission that needs to be built in the state. And when you look at what we're doing down there, and you heard Elliot mention that the California ISO has stated that we have all of the transmission that we're going to need to meet our 33% renewable standard, I can't help but believe that that is the case. When you look at the projects that are being built, there's $15 billion in new transmission that has been approved by the California Public Utilities Commission and approved by FERC, and most of it is in the process of being built. Some is being held up in the desert areas due to litigation. But combined, that's going to access somewhere north of 30,000 megawatts of new renewable resources in the Southern California, Nevada border, Arizona border region. So a lot of new construction. When you extrapolate that out to what is that going to cost California utilities and ratepayers, that's about $10 per megawatt hour in new transmission access charges just for that new transmission that's being built. And so, as you heard a gentleman from Southern California Edison just mention, it's going to be tough to pursue out-of-state resources when you're making that kind of in-state investment. The other thing that's going on that I think will significantly affect what happens in-state versus out-of-state is we not only have the Renewable Portfolio Standard, but we have a bill called Assembly Bill 32, which is going to require utilities to maintain a certain CO2 emissions level. And so, in the short run, while the RPS is kind of driving activities, in the long run, it's going to be carbon. And so as we look to the future, we don't know what the cap-and-trade rule is going to look like or if there's going to be a cap-and-trade rule, but that's certainly going to influence procurement activities. And if it does come to pass, there's going to be more of a focus on real resources where you're reducing carbon as opposed to renewable energy credits. So probably more than I had expected to say, but listening to all the comments today, I thought it might be helpful. Thanks.
That's great, Dave. Any clarifying questions for the panelists or the folks from California?
It's Neil Miller here again to the people on the phone. I just wanted to add one clarifying comment because I've also heard a paraphrased version of the ISO's position a few times about we have all the transmission we need. I just need to clarify that the position of the ISO is that we believe at the point in time we're at, we have enough approved projects at this time. We do have a transmission plan that was recently approved by our Board of Governors that did provide enough transmission to provide a way for the state or for the ISO to meet its 33% RPS obligations. That is one path forward, but not necessarily the only one, and it is based on planning assumptions. Through our annual process, we will be reviewing those assumptions, especially as the procurement decisions of the load-serving entities firm up. And if that does drive the need for additional transmission, then we will be moving forward with additional transmission. So I just wanted to clarify that the statements about attributed to the ISO in general around enough transmission did have a qualifier on it, which is very important. Thank you.
Thanks. So again, any clarifying questions for these folks?
Just to John Savage, Oregon PC, just for the California utilities, there's been no mention of either sort of views on intertie upgrade or a DC upgrade. I'd just be interested in sort of the California views of those potential upgrades.
Anyone want to weigh in on that?
Guess not.
As I was just mentioning, from our perspective, there are a number of projects that have been proposed that would provide either new capacity or upgrades to existing facilities, and we will be looking at a number of those, continuing to evaluate those as we go through our annual planning cycles. At this point, with the procurement objectives and the portfolios for generation development that we've looked at, we hadn't identified the need for additional reinforcement of major interties at this time, but that is one of the major assumptions that needs to be tested and validated as we move forward.
Did you want to weigh in on that, Mark?
I think Elliot had mentioned the price tag for some of the upgrades, and it's something we'd be interested in looking at, but the economics has to work out. I don't want to spend $1 billion to save a $100 million problem.
Okay, thanks.
I think Angus was first.
Oh, sorry, Angus?
Yeah. Thank you. I'm interested in the comment about that I think Dave Dockham made about the potential delta between California's renewable portfolio standard target and its carbon reduction target. And I wonder whether anyone has down in California has looked at that delta and how big it is.
Well, over at the ISO, I'm getting to talk more than I thought today as well. We are looking at running a number of studies basically in parallel as we're moving through the year. The ones through cooling requirements, air quality, taking a look at the carbon reduction requirements. But this is all work simultaneously in progress with meeting the 33% RPS standards. So as I mentioned, we have a number of moving parts right now, but we are in the middle of that as part of the next cycle of annual transmission planning process. Now, I should also mention that when we're doing our work, we're largely turning to the state agencies, the CPUC, the California Energy Commission, for load forecasting and additional input, and in the future are relying more heavily on the portfolios developed by the state agencies for planning input. So we'll also be looking to them to see how that work is evolving in their processes.
Rachel.
Have you guys taken a look at the interaction among and between the renewable resources and traditional generation between the regions or just in California? I'm trying to get at whether that scenario has been looked at as one of the things that you're evaluating.
Actually, there's a great deal of analysis going on at the ISO right now around the last year's transmission plan was focusing on what does it take to actually deliver the energy. As well, there are studies going on at the different levels of renewable energy penetration regarding the additional load following, reserve requirement capabilities, and so on. And there are studies available on our website showing what those requirements look like to us now at the 20% level. Preliminary results at 33% are also available. And we have also been working on intrastate or interstate issues around dynamic scheduling and so on. What does that look like? But that's definitely one of those moving parts. There's a great deal of analysis, and I'd encourage you to take a look at our website where we have study results, at preliminary results at 33% level as well.
Bill?
Bill Drummond. I was curious, Stefan, did I capture correctly, you have about 2,000 megawatts of wind in your balancing authority?
Correct.
And how much of that is exported, and how much is used for native load?
Very little. Very often, it's from third parties, but not the
materiality. Because Stefan said almost all the their wind is used to be native load.
And Elliot, Bonneville's about 60%? It's exported?
No, it's more than that. It's probably closer to 85.
85
yeah.
In your balancing authority is exported?
Yeah, under contract to non-Bonneville new load customers.
I'd be remiss, Neil, if I didn't say that Beach for Grets planning seems to be an awfully pessimistic way to approach the world.
Well, with $7.2 billion underway right now, we want to make sure we get it in the right spot. So the most regret scenario wouldn't look too viable either. Thanks.
Bill, I just put more bounds on us, if I remember correctly, 1,735 or active for.
Thank you.
Oh, sorry, Scott.
Another just a clarifying one, and I guess it may be for Elliot, but I thought I heard Ms. Bean talk about capability on the Enterprise during the environmental redispatch events, and it colored her characterization of those. But what was you didn't touch on that with a lot of specificity in your presentation, or whether there was load extra regional to move generation to that, and to what extent?
Our understanding at this point is that prices in California for a significant number of the hours that environmental redispatches have been in zero negative territory as well. So the demand for power in California has been pretty limited. They've been experiencing I think as a percentage of average, I think the snowpack in California this year is even higher than it is in the Northwest. They've had their hydro coming off, and there just hasn't been a lot of demand for power. So given the policy that's on the books right now, we haven't gone after any more of that.
Thanks.
This is Tim Culbertson from Grant. And, Elliot, we talked a little bit about this last week, and just curiosity for me, I understand that in California, but then you go a step further and you look at the ties to the desert Southwest, and one would have to wonder, are you filling those ties with energy, those light load hours? Or could you possibly move Northwest energy through the California system to the desert Southwest? But I would have to assume the ties are going unloaded. You're loading the ties to the desert Southwest with oversupply of generation from California.
Tim, I can't give you a super definitive answer to that. I know, maybe I'll turn to Brian at some point, but I think what we have been hearing, we have had some conversations, is that it's certainly going east. The additional available transmission capacity to get power east to any of the additional thermals appears to have been loaded up unavailable. And Teresa may have some comments about going to the north side, but certainly in California we've offered up as much zero-priced electricity as we've been able to and haven't had any additional takers. But I think that there is, you know, last week there was some dialogue among some parties. Steve Oliver of Bonneville had pulled some folks together to get the operators looking if there's anything being left on the table, and I think there were some follow-up assignments coming out of that meeting that may result in some success there. So,
Teresa Conway, PowerX. I guess there's interties north and as well as the southern interties, and my understanding is there's space available going north. So I just go back to the comment on whether it's load or economics on both the interties.
Yeah, Jim.
Jim Lovedell, Portland General Electric. I guess one of the questions I've got, Elliot, is on the environmental redispatch, how effective has that been? And I've also heard some back-channel conversations about it's always been looked at as being a temporary policy. Is it now being considered, based on some of the information that was presented today, is it being considered to be extended long-term, not be so temporary as we originally thought?
In terms of discretionary actions that we can take to minimize incremental total dissolved gas during those times when loads are just not there, it's been working quite effectively from a physical perspective. I think if you go off and you look at our website, you look at the graphs, and you know, to their credit, the wind generation community has been almost impeccable in their compliance with the dispatch orders. You see, we hit midnight and the wind fleet is just coming down. So in terms of redressing the physical oversupply issue, it's been very effective. Obviously, this is a very, very massive water year, and the total dissolved gas levels have been really quite high in some places, even with everything we can possibly do on environmental redispatch. So it's sort of, you know, mitigating. What it's basically been doing is sort of putting a buffer between that point when we really hit some of the limits. So I think physically it's been working sort of as designed. I think your question about, I think we all hope, I know everybody at Bonneville is certainly hoping that we can find another long-term solution to this. And it is, the policy itself has a sort of termination, I think, towards the end of next spring. So we think coming out of this spring, we're going to try to have our heads down as much as we possibly can, looking for other alternatives. But I think there definitely is this, you know, there is an economic issue at play. We all know that, and we have to find a clean way to deal with that.
And in that spirit, so it's noon. It's time to break for lunch. After lunch, we've got we cut into it a little bit. We've got a half hour set aside for the steering committee members around the table to do what the others have done, basically weigh in. How does the world look to you? What's your experience been with wind, just to flesh out this kind of learning part we're doing here? Again, we're not talking solutions yet. And after that, we'll turn to solutions.